Well, good evening to everyone tonight. It's great to be with you as we think about some big questions tonight, and as we begin this new series, is the Bible reliable? If you're a Christian here tonight, I hope that you'll find this talk encouraging as you find out what historians actually do say about the Bible. Because many younger Christians haven't had time to learn these things, and they may be surprised to find out what historians actually say. Maybe you're not a Christian, and so you're not really sure what to think either. I guess if you were just listening to what you hear on the TV and in the documentaries, you'd probably come away with the idea that the Bible is just a whole lot of myths. It's full of contradictions. They're the types of things that I get on my Facebook feed from other people, and that I've certainly seen in the documentaries. And that's why it's an important question to look at this tonight. Is the Bible reliable? In particular, the question for tonight is it historical? I'm going to be looking at just the New Testament, that is the section explicitly about Jesus, just for time. You can do the Old Testament as well, but we're just doing the New Testament tonight. Now, what do we mean when we ask this question, is the New Testament historical? Well, what we mean is, what I mean by it is it describing real people and real events? That's how I'm defining history, real people and real events. Now, how do you answer that? How do you answer that for something over 2,000 years ago? How do you answer that? Well, what I want to do is I want to look at how any historian, a professional historian in a university, would answer that. They would ask these types of questions. They'd ask, what is this document? Who wrote it? How many independent sources do we have of this event? Is it coherent or is it contradictory? Does it fit in with the rest of known history? And how do other historians view it? So they're the points that I'm going to quickly go through tonight, and then we'll have an opportunity for questions at the end. Let's look at the first of these then. What is the New Testament? Now, by this, what I'm meaning is it claiming to be a historical type of document? Because sometimes people write stories. We had Harry Potter mentioned before. That's not claiming to be history. It's claiming to be a story. That's what it's claiming. It's claiming to be a novel. Now, what about the New Testament? Is it claiming to be a novel or is it claiming to be a myth? Myths were known in the ancient world and they were known as myths. Well, what do we find when we look at the New Testament? Well, what we find is that it contains the letters from the apostles of Jesus, and these letters talk about Jesus as a real person. They talk about him as having done certain things, and they explain to us the meaning of what he's done. It's interesting that letters are what historians actually use when they write their history. So if you read a history of Captain Cook, the historian would have got his letters and then read Captain Cook's letters and then from those wrote up his history. We have those almost pre-historical documents here in the letters of the apostles of Jesus. We've, of course, in the New Testament got the Gospels, which are proclamations or declarations, the telling of Jesus' life. And when you read it, as we'll see a bit later on, that they claim that they're telling you what Jesus actually did. And, of course, the New Testament has one book of visions, the book of Revelation, and that's a vision of Jesus. But when we look at these books and take them on their own terms, they are saying that they're talking about a real event. They're talking about God acting in history in the person of Jesus Christ and what that means for us. That's just what the documents claim. Now, my second point is who wrote the New Testament? Now, this is an important question to know because were these people who wrote it in a position to know? If they're not in a position to know, then we need to know that, don't we? So who were the people who wrote it? Well, the New Testament documents, these letters and accounts of Jesus' life, they were written, they tell us, by the disciples of Jesus and John the Baptist and their companions. So the early Christians were followers of John the Baptist first, then of Jesus, And they are the ones who were commissioned by Jesus to pass on his teaching. And they did so, and sometimes they had their companions help write the New Testament with them. Now, we see this in that the New Testament actually names who wrote it. So you'll see here, it's a little bit smaller, that print, but this is the start of one of the letters. And notice how it starts. Peter, an apostle of Christ Jesus, to God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. So here we see that this is a letter, and it's actually addressed from a person to someone else. So we can actually know who wrote it, and it's the apostle Peter wrote this. Now, it's often claimed that we do not know who the authors are of the Gospels. You'll hear this type of thing. I heard, was listening to the ABC radio not so long ago, and they were saying that in the afternoon. You know, it's written by unknown people, anonymous people. And you'll often hear this claim that they're anonymous authors of the Gospels in particular. Now, I want to give five quick reasons why this is not the case. First of all, the word anonymous does not mean unknown. They sort of smuggle in their conclusion in their premise there, and they say, oh, it's anonymous, therefore it's unknown. Well, they're two different ideas. Just because you don't put your name to it doesn't mean it's unknown, the person's unknown. Secondly, they're not anonymous because all of the ancient manuscripts that we have all have the name Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John associated with the manuscript. And we can go right back to the 3rd century, and there's no reason to think that the titles were never there. They're there in all the ancient manuscripts. Eusebius is one of the early church fathers. You can read about him as he discusses the authorship of the different New Testament documents, because the early church weren't gullible. They discussed who the authors were. And if they didn't know, they said they didn't know. You can actually read that in books like Eusebius's Ecclesiastical History. Now, evidence of this actually comes with the book of Hebrews in the Bible. It's a very interesting book because we don't know who wrote it. Now, if you listen to the skeptical academics, what they'll say is that the people like Bart Ehrman will say this, that they had all these New Testament documents, they had all these documents, and they had to put a name to it to authenticate it. And so they put different names to these documents. This is what you hear people saying. Well, why didn't they do that with Hebrews? Hebrews is in the Bible because of its ancient use, because of its orthodoxy, and because there is a reference to the writer being one of the companions of the apostles, but we actually don't know who he was. So they're simply not inventing names. It's just false when they say they're inventing names and putting it to this, because we've got documents in there which don't have a name. Okay. The early church did not invent names. In fact, when we go back in our church history to the ancient quotes, as far back as we can go outside of the Bible, to a man named Papias, his writing around the year AD 110, 120, he talks about Matthew and Mark having gospels. Now, working out exactly what he means by that, you know, there's some questions there, but we never get people saying the gospels are anonymous or we don't know who wrote them. The earliest accounts we have from the very start of the 2nd century is the names are there. So I just want to say there's simply no good reason for saying that they're anonymous documents. Now, why do these people who wrote these documents, what is it that makes them good for history? Well, it's basically because they're the disciples of Jesus. They were trained by him, and they're the eyewitnesses. They're the eyewitnesses. So let's look at a few references here. What have we got there? Have a look at how the disciples describe themselves. That which was from the beginning, this is a way of talking about Jesus, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked at and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, we have seen it and testify to it, and we proclaim to you the word of life, which was with the Father and has appeared to us. Now, that's the word of a witness, isn't it? Notice what he's saying there. He's talking about Jesus. It's in figurative language of from the beginning and the word of life, but he's speaking about Jesus and he's saying, our eyes have seen, our hands have touched. That's the type of witness these people were. In the next quote you'll see here is from the start of Luke's gospel. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who were from the first eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning. It seemed good to me also to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. Now notice there again, this is one of the companions of the Apostle Paul. His name's Luke, and he's saying that he's got this information from the eyewitnesses themselves. The eyewitnesses who we just saw were the disciples of Jesus. Now, I just want to point out something here. What I've just said to you here is not unusual. We can often think when it comes to the Bible, you know, we slip into conspiracy mode. And this is what you'll hear on Facebook and on the documentaries that you see around the place. Because how do we know about Socrates? We know about him from Plato. How do we know about most of the teachers of the world? Well, it's from their students from the ancient world who passed on their teaching. That's actually very normal. And I just want to challenge people, if you're skeptical, because very often people move into conspiracy theory mode. And they say, when it comes to the Bible, it was all done under Emperor Constantine and the Vatican Church and the Catholic Church. You know, haven't you seen, what was that movie with the bloodline of Jesus? Oh, sorry, I was just watching it. I've forgotten it now. The Da Vinci Code. And so you've got all these conspiracies. Jesus went over to France and had children, and that's got to be true. And so we've just got to be careful, particularly if you're a Christian. You'll hear people who are basically conspiracy theorists. Even on the ABC, you'll hear conspiracy theory level of arguments against Christianity. And so what I've just said here is absolutely perfectly normal for a teacher to have students and the students to write up about their life and pass on their teaching. That is the normal process. And it's a conspiracy. You're believing in conspiracies if you think that that couldn't happen. Now we need to realize how early these accounts are. They are actually very early that we have. So one of the letters in the New Testament we can date. It's the letter of Galatians, and it comes from the year AD 48. So AD 48, Jesus dies and is raised AD 33. So we're talking 15 years after Jesus. That is really close. That's really close. So what's 15 years ago? 2017, somebody do the maths for me. 2017, something like that. Sorry, 2007. 2007. 2007, that's not that long ago, right? So we've actually got documents in that time frame. Now, I'm going to compare this to some other religions so you get an idea. This is the earliest biography of Muhammad's life that we've actually had to reconstruct. And that's 120 years after Muhammad. 120 years. What about the life of Buddha? It's actually 350 years after his life is when we get the first accounts. So I hope you can see that when it comes to the life of Jesus, we are incredibly early. Just have a look at this quote here. You can see where, I've got the little, see this here? So that this is from the Apostle Paul, and he's writing around the year 52 AD. He planted the church in Corinth around 50 AD, and then he writes a letter to them a few years later. And in it, he says, "For what I received from the Lord, I passed on to you also, that the Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the covenant in my blood, do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me.'" Now, those statements in commas there, if you're reading your Bible, you'll know that they come from the Gospels. So just think about this. What we have here is the Apostle Paul in AD 52 quoting the material that we have in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it's word for word quotation. So this means that 17 years after Jesus' death and resurrection, we've already got the material that we find in Matthew, Mark, and Luke being quoted as scripture in just 17 years. That is unbelievable. That is so close to Jesus. You see, anyway, there we go. So you see, the people who wrote the New Testament, they were the right people at the right time. The Bible has the oldest documents on the life of Jesus. There are no other earlier documents. These are the earliest, and these go right back 15, 17 years, and we can actually see them identical to what we've got today. Now, another question that historians ask is, how many sources do we have for this? Are we just relying on one person telling us, or are there multiple people who are sort of independent from each other talking to us? And what we find is that when we come to the New Testament, we have many different people telling us about Jesus. And they use their own language. They use sometimes different words to describe him, different concepts. But they are describing the same Jesus, but just in their own way, their own language, their own particular way of speaking. And so we've got the testimony from the Jerusalem church with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. We've got the Gospel of John, which is a very different source. We've got Paul's writings, Peter's writings, and James's writings. And when scholars count all these up, apparently there's 8 different independent sources testifying to Jesus' life. Now, this is important because if one person tells you something, you go, okay, one person's told me. But if 2 people tell you, then you go, okay, well, now 2 people have told me this. If you get 8 people telling you, it means there are 8 different streams going back to this event of Jesus. That's actually quite a lot. That's a lot of different streams of information that we can trace back to Jesus. Now, my fourth point is that this is exactly the type of evidence you would expect if the Jesus story was true. If Jesus was true and he was this religious figure in the way that we're saying, you would get these stories coming out from him. You get different people passing it on, and that's exactly what we find. Now, the next point I want to look at is it contradictory or is it coherent or contradictory? And so the idea here is, okay, we've got these documents, but are they giving us a consistent picture of Jesus? And again, the accusation that is brought against Christians is that the Bible's full of contradictions. And you do hear this type of thing. Well, I do. People keep sending it my way. That the Bible's full of contradictions and, you know, it's you just can't trust it. As I said, you pick these things up, you hear them. Well, I want to say it's overwhelmingly consistent in terms of the life, death, resurrection, and the message of Jesus. You've just got to read them. In fact, the proof of that is how academics call the gospel accounts. So there's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called synoptic. Now, the word synoptic means, it's word syn in Greek, which means together. So synagogue means together. It's the idea of syn meaning together, and optic meaning eye. And so the word synoptic, they're called the synoptic gospels, means that they're similar, they're seen together. And so when you read them, you get the same life of Jesus. You get the same life of Jesus coming up again. They're overwhelmingly consistent. But because the Bible gives us, the Gospels give us so much information about Jesus, you know, like, for instance, it won't just say Jesus went from here to there. Sometimes it will say he went from here to there, and it will tell you the distance. Now, that's giving you real details, isn't it? They're the details of an eyewitness. And so sometimes it can give you so many details that it might appear to be contradictory. So I'm going to give you two examples here. One example from two verses. So have a look at this. As Jesus and his disciples were leaving Jericho, a large crowd followed. Two blind men were sitting by the roadside, and when they heard that Jesus was going by, they shouted, "Lord, Son of David, have mercy on us." So he's leaving Jericho, two men, pointed out. But then in Luke's gospel, we read this. So in one gospel, we read leaving Jericho and two men. But in Luke's gospel, hang on, is it Luke? Yes, Luke. As he approached Jerusalem, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard the crowd going by, he asked what was happening. They told him, "Jesus of Nazareth is passing by." He called out, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." So, seems to be a few differences there. What do we do with those ones? In one, he's leaving Jericho, and in another, he's entering Jericho. In one, there's one man. In the other, there's two. Well, sorry, in one, it just says a man, and the other, it says two. Well, let's look at the number of men, first of all. There's no problem there. One is just being more specific. One says there were two men. The other one just says a man called out. So it's not specifying the number. So that's the type of difference you'd expect between eyewitness accounts, isn't it? A man called out, two men, one of them called out. But what about the entering and leaving? Because that sounds a bit harder. Well, what's interesting is that when Herod the Great was doing his building projects, he built his palace just outside of Jericho. It was his Jericho palace, and a whole town was around it. So what it means is that, and this seems to be the explanation, that there were two centers to Jericho. This new center around the palace, which you could imagine would have a lot of trade and everything around the palace, and everything associated there with all the soldiers, there'd be a lot of business. And then you had older Jericho next door. So it was actually possible to be leaving Jericho and entering Jericho. Okay. Now, what this shows us is that the Bible may actually have more detail than you're in a position to judge. See, if you didn't know about Herod building his palace near Jericho, you might look at that and say, clear contradiction. But that's only because you're ignorant. And you actually don't know stuff, right? Because unfortunately, this is what people do. They think, I can judge the Bible. I know better. There's so many historical background information to this that we don't know. I want to give you a couple of other examples. And what have I got here? See, first of all, the New Testament provides a coherent account, and when we're able to judge it, it stands up well. I want to move on to my fifth point now. How does it fit into known history? How does it fit into known history? Because if Jesus did live at a certain time, maybe how does the New Testament fit into the rest of history? Because we've got a lot of history from that time. Well, what we see is that there are lots of connections which affirm what we read in the Bible from outside of history. When it talks about the people, the kings, the rulers at the time, the customs, the geography, the distances between places, it's written in the right language, it's written in the Greek language of that time. And the topics that Jesus is discussing, we know were the topics being discussed at that time. So it actually fits really well. In fact, I was reading some of the Cambridge History of the Eastern Roman World of some time ago, and they're often footnoting the Bible in the Cambridge History of the World. They're often footnoting it to give their evidence for things. When it comes to archaeology, there's been a new one. You may like to follow this up with Jesus and the witnesses in Richard Borkham's book. He talks about how paper from the ancient world doesn't survive very well. We've got some manuscripts from the ancient world, but a lot of it doesn't survive. But what does survive is tombstones. You can imagine tombstones survive, don't they? And so what they've done is they've discovered thousands and thousands of tombstones all around the Middle East, and they've put them into a database. And so what it allows them to know is, in any region, what at the, at, in any region at any particular time, what were the names that were being used in that region at that time, and how were they constructed? And in chapter 4, he takes you through all this data, and what you actually find is that what the names that we find in the Gospels fit perfectly to around the region of Jerusalem and Galilee to the first century. So archaeologically, what we have fits in with what we have in the New Testament. Now, over the centuries, academics have claimed that the Gospels were wrong, and time again, they've been proven false. So, for instance, the Pool of Siloam, it's a pool with water in it, mentioned in John chapter 5, it had academic consensus that it was fictitious. It was just a story written up in the second century. And then when the Jews were building a road in 1960, they found it. They actually found the pool, and it's actually got the five pillars that were there. So even the exact detail that John's Gospel gives us that had been covered over for, you know, centuries or millennia, when they're digging up their roads, making their roads for wherever, they found it. Nazareth, they said, there is no town called Nazareth. Again, this is what the academics were saying. 2006, they found it. And then, of course, with another recent one was they were saying there was no synagogue in Capernaum, but now they've found it. So this is what I mean. You just need to be careful before you go writing off the Bible as being unreliable, because academics and universities have had scholarly consensus and then they're proven wrong. You just need to be careful before you start judging the Bible. Now, I want to look at the historical records now. So the books, and I'm going to begin with Josephus. Josephus is a first century non-Christian Jewish writer, and he's writing of what was commonly known in Jerusalem in the first century. So it's a big book, and I want to give you a couple of quotes here. So what have we got here? Now I'll go down to this one first. Look at who he speaks about in his book. He says, "So he, King Agrippa, assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who is called Christ, whose name is James." It's interesting, isn't it, that a first century non-Christian Roman historian knows about Jesus' brother, because Jesus' brother was a significant person in Jerusalem. So it's not just that Jesus, and I'm going to get to Jesus in a minute, it's not just that Jesus is mentioned in this, but his brother's mentioned in it. Let's go on to the next one. Now, some of the Jews thought that the destruction of Herod's army came from God, and that very justly as a punishment of what he did against John, that is called the Baptist. For Herod slew him, who was a good man, and commanded the Jews to exercise virtue, both as righteousness towards one another and piety towards God, and to come to baptism. So again, here's a non-Christian historian. And what's he saying? He's saying John the Baptist was a real person. He was calling people to baptism, and Herod had him executed. It's precisely what we find in the Bible, isn't it? Now, this is what he writes about Jesus. Oh, sorry, no, I'll go back. There we go. He says, "At this time there was a wise man who was called Jesus, and his conduct was good, and he was known to be virtuous. And many people from among the Jews and from other nations became his disciples. Pilate condemned him to be crucified and to die, and those who became his disciples did not abandon his discipleship. They reported that he appeared to them 3 days after his crucifixion and was alive. Accordingly, he was perhaps the Messiah, of whom the prophets have recounted wonders." Now, you can tell he's not a Christian. He's saying, you know, perhaps. But he's testifying to Jesus' life, isn't he, about his death, that he had disciples, and where he was. Now, we have other references in the Babylonian Talmud. So this is in the writing of the Jews who didn't accept Jesus. They talk about Yeshua, which is Jesus' name in Hebrew. Yeshua had five disciples: Mattai, Nachtai, Netzar, Buni, and Toda. And so it talks about his disciples. Okay. I'm not expecting those names to match up easily. They'd come through a Hebrew tradition. Maybe Matthew matches up easily. But you wouldn't expect a group of outsiders to know all the names of everyone inside. But then it talks about Jesus and his death. Yeshua was hanged on the Passover Eve. Now, again, this is a non-Christian Jewish account. I'm not going to read all of it now. But it talks about him being hanged, or that is crucified, that's how they described it, on the Passover time. And there are other references in other things which I'm not going to have time to look at now. Oh, no, sorry, I've got one more to go. So this is the Roman historian Tacitus, and he writes at the early 2nd century. He says, Christians derived their name from a man called Christ, who during the reign of Emperor Tiberius had been executed by the sentence of the procurator Pontius Pilate. The deadly superstition, thus checked for the moment, broke out afresh not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but also in the city of Rome. Now, he's not favourable to Christians at all. He doesn't like them. He sees them as a pernicious superstition, a deadly superstition. But he talks about Jesus being crucified under Pontius Pilate, and this is a highly significant Roman ruler recording this history for us. Now, there are a few problems with the history of the New Testament. As I said, when you get lots of detail, sometimes they're not that easy to explain. So two of them would be to do with Luke's description of Jesus and his birth. There's the problem of when Quirinius was governor, and there's the problem of when the census was taken and how that fits in with what we know from outside of history. But when it comes to the census, Luke is specific in saying this was the second census, and we only know of the first from outside of history. So there may be a solution that we just don't know. And with Quirinius being the governor, we know that Quirinius was actually active in that time, and he may have been a co-governor, but we can't pin those ones down. So I'm not saying there are no problems, but generally there are solutions, but we don't have enough information to sort them out. So my point here, before I finish up, is that when we can test the New Testament, which we can in many places because of the details it gives us, it actually stands up as being very accurate and fits in to the general history of what we know of the time. Now, I want to move on to my last point here, and that is, how do historians view the New Testament? And I want to begin with this first quote by Dr. John Dixon. He says here, professional historians, regardless of their religious persuasion, treat the New Testament and its portrait of Jesus Christ far more seriously than the general public realizes. Again, what you just hear in the documentaries and all that type of thing, it tends to be sensationalism is the technical word. It's sensationalist. You know how you have clickbait, where you want people, you have some little clickbait to get people there. They've got to make it sensational to get your attention. But John Dixon's saying here that academics take it far more seriously than we might know. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to give you a secular, so that is a non-Christian historian. So I just got this book from the University of Tasmania down the road. And so I read it, and this is what he says we can know from general history. So what have we got here? He says, so this is E.P. Sanders. He just died recently, and he's one of the standard historians on the life of Jesus, just from an academic university level. He says, I shall first offer a list of statements about Jesus that meet two standards. They are almost beyond dispute, and they belong to the framework of his life and especially his public career. A list of everything that we know about Jesus would be appreciatively longer. So what is it? Jesus was born around 4 BC. Near the time of the death of Herod the Great. He spent his childhood and early years in Nazareth, a Galilean village. He was baptized by John the Baptist. He called disciples. He taught in the town, village, and countryside of Galilee. He preached the kingdom of God. At about the year 30, he went to Jerusalem for Passover. He caused a disturbance in the temple area. He had a final meal with his disciples. He was arrested and interrogated by Jewish authorities, specifically the high priest, and he was executed on the orders of the Roman prefect, Pontius Pilate? Were we to add here a short list of equally secure facts about the aftermath of Jesus' life, they would be: his disciples at first fled, then they saw him, in what sense is not certain, after his death. That's interesting, isn't it? That a non-Christian would say his disciples had some experience of him after his death, but I can't say what it is. As a consequence, they believe he would return and found a kingdom, and they formed a community to wait for his return and sought to win others to faith in him as God's Messiah. So I hope you can see there, that's pretty well what you've got in the gospel as well. And that's a non-Christian historian who is applying the rules of history to the gospels. So I'm going to finish up now. Tonight we've been looking at the question of, is the New Testament history? If you're a Christian, I hope you've been encouraged to see that when we take the New Testament as it stands, from just a purely historical point of view, that you can engage with it and that it stands up well. It can be engaged with as a historical document, and it stands up well, and academic scholars in this area treat it as a historical document. Right? They treat it as they treat other historical documents, but they use it in understanding history. If you're not a Christian, then I really hope that tonight it's just made you think again about the Christian faith. I hope it helps you to see that it's not just a myth that Christians are talking about here. There's no evidence at all of it being a myth. There's no evidence of it being a conspiracy. There's actually good historical grounds that you can consider for the life of Jesus. And if you haven't done so, I want to encourage you to get a Bible yourself and to read one of the accounts of Jesus' life and to find out about him for yourself. Thank you.